again for the introduction, Gene, and for all the logistics of getting us to this place. Much appreciated. And to all of you online, thanks for finding the time to join us for this webinar on implementing greener cleanups through ASTM's standard guide. Those of you who have been following this topic, you might recall that while we have been to several training events in multiple locations around the country, both within the agency, with states, at conferences such as Patel, et cetera, getting people up to speed on this, we have not had a webinar since April 25th, 2014, so we thought it was a good time to do that. We've made a lot of progress moving forward with the implementation of the standard guide, and that's what we hope to bring to you today. Let me go to slide number 2. So that was the thinking behind putting together our agenda for today. I'm going to spend a few minutes recapping what used to be a lot of the emphasis of previous webinars, how we have gone about defining what greener cleanups are. You know, we used to spend a lot of time clarifying policy within the agency and other EPA and other agencies. I'm going to condense that quite a bit because that has already been covered in previous webinars and trainings. Brief introduction to the development of the implementation tool, the ASTM Standard Guide. Very brief introduction because Deb Goldblum is later going to speak in more detail about how the guide actually works. And then most important of all, we want to see how things are rolling out in the field. So we've chosen four applications of the standard guide across cleanup programs. The first one, we have Michelle Mullen from Region 10. will be giving us some insights from a regional perspective of EPA's Region 10. They are out in Seattle, on how they are pursuing the application of the standard guide at the PCB cleanups. Following Michelle, we have two presenters speaking on a project called North Ridge Estates. The angle there is this is a Superfund cleanup. It's actually a fund lead Superfund cleanup. And Beth Sheldrake will be covering some perspectives from the agency, from the program point of view. And then we have Mike Miller of CDM, who is the contractor that actually implemented a lot of the work, and here are some of his insights. We then move on to middle of the country, Chicago, Public Building Commission. Leanne Thomas Foster will be describing how they went about implementing a greener cleanup with using the standard guide at a site in the city of Chicago with collaboration from Illinois EPA. So anyway, that's the third speaker. And finally, John Simon, we come all the way to the East Coast. He will describe some of the BMPs implemented, how they were selected, et cetera, at a RCRA corrective action cleanup that was completed in Connecticut. After that, we'll have a short discussion, and we'll follow on with question and answer. As Gene mentioned, we have a couple of participant poll questions. Well, actually, we have about 7 or 8 of them that we will be presenting to you throughout this webinar. Part of the discussion at the end, we'll be covering reviewing your feedback in response to those questions. So thanks for taking the time to answer those. Okay, let's move on to the first slide of mine. So as I mentioned, we've made quite significant progress in cleaning up contaminated sites across the U.S. A lot of our programs, such as Superfund, have been in place literally for decades. But unfortunately, there's still quite a bit of work to be done, and often that work is closely co-located to population centers. This is a recent analysis that the OSWR office, where all cleanup programs are located here in headquarters, completed regarding location of population centers location of site listed sites in relation to population centers. A few obvious things to point out, given the historic nature of those previously contaminated sites or contaminated sites, usually it was associated with some type of industrial activity. So they are likely located near population centers. Just looking at the map, you can see that they relate closely to where the population centers are in the United States. But taking a closer look at actual data, what we see in that little bar chart there on the right is that, in fact, about 51% of the U.S. population is located within 3 miles of either a Superfund, RCRA corrective action, brownfields, or Superfund site. That is close to 50%, it's actually 51% of the U.S. population. So what's clear is that we are addressing these sites to protect human health and environment. But in doing that work, what we recognize is that as any type of construction activity, it's got an environmental footprint of its own. If we can address that environmental footprint, we'll have a direct benefit, in addition to protecting human health and environment, on quite a significant proportion of the population that lives near those sites. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So what is this environmental footprint? Well, there's a couple of things. One is at a global scale. Another is at a local. And these are not unique. I just want to use them as examples of the significance of environmental footprints. The first is in 2012, we did an analysis of the carbon footprint of the Superfund program. And our estimate is that annually, just from operating remedies in the Superfund program, our carbon footprint is approximately 404,000 metric tons of CO2, which is equivalent to emissions from 25,000 automobiles. Now, across the economy, that may not seem that large, but all of us should be taking some action to address the footprint to the extent possible, and that is our own energy footprint. The question is, what can we do through efficiencies, renewables, et cetera, to address our carbon footprint? That's at a global scale. At a local scale, I want to point out this analysis that was performed by a PhD intern we had here, Charlene Lawson, a couple of years ago. She's finishing her thesis in atmospheric chemistry and modeling, and she ran this model for her. I put the URL to her paper at the bottom if you want to look it up. But we thought it was quite interesting. She modeled a fictional site. We put in types of typical equipment you would find associated with it, with that cleanup. And she modeled it in a, I think it was a thermal inversion situation. And what we saw here is that using plain old technology, yellow iron, you could say, in a thermal inversion situation, emissions from the equipment on site contributed to tropospheric ozone. That would be the blue line there. And the straight line, the green line, would be the National Air Quality Standards level for action level for ozone at 0.075 parts per million. So basically, we see a daily cycle there. As days went on and that thermal inversion persisted, we saw an increase in tropospheric ozone, whereas the red line, if that equipment had been fitted with, in this case, selective catalytic reduction, we would actually see a decrease in tropospheric ozone. So again, this is a model, but it is intended to represent the types of benefits that we would see from implementation of air quality best management practices at our cleanup sites. Okay, let's go to the next slide and maybe go a little bit broader into what that environmental footprint is. On a big scale, environmental footprint, well, that's my next slide. But the goal of greener cleanups or green remediation, which is in practice the same, has the same meaning, is looking at all the environmental effects of remedy implementation and incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprints of cleanup actions. A couple of caveats. This is not only about greenhouse gases, as we'll discuss in a few minutes, and it's not about choosing the greenest technology. About given the technology that gets us to a cleanup level, how can we implement that technology with a lower environmental footprint? Okay, let's go to the next slide. A little bit more on environmental footprints. So we broke out the environmental footprint into what we call these core elements. They're intended to help us understand what I guess an economist might call negative externalities of the work necessary to implement, to protect human health and environment, to implement those remedies. We break it out across these five core elements, energy, and really what we're looking at there is reducing energy, increasing energy efficiency, and applying renewables where possible. On the air side, again, this is just a quick summary, but the concept there is protecting air quality, kind of like what I just described earlier with that graph. reducing greenhouse gas emissions. With respect to water, we want to minimize impacts on local quality, decrease freshwater use, and increase reuse of the water that may be generated on the site. With respect to materials and waste, it's the same as the classic concepts there, that minimize material use, reuse materials and recycle where possible. And finally, with land and ecosystems, that is a relatively new area. You may know that EPA and others are looking at ecosystem services. Those are being quantified, and tools are being developed to measure them. We're looking more closely into that, and we hope to have some updates on that angle soon. Okay, so now we move on to the next slide. The question is, what do these BMPs look like in the field? And here's four examples of BMPs currently or recently used across multiple cleanup programs. The good news is that these are already out there. A couple of examples are, first, clean air. This picture is taken at Elizabeth Mine in EPA Region 1. These are next generation Tier 4 equipment with diesel electric powertrain and NOx, SOx, and PM reduction. This is in the state of Vermont. This is a great example, and actually one of our presentations from Northridge Estates, you'll see what the implications are of using Tier 4 equipment versus regular Tier 1 equipment at our sites. But as usual, we have to think about these things up front. If we don't ask for this before we go into the project, it's usually too late. We can't be switching out this equipment. And the standard guide helps us think about these things, ask these questions up front. So that's one example. The other example is with respect to energy. This is at a site, a Superfund site, I think it's called Pennsylvania Mine. It's in the state of Colorado. And what they did here is that they used an off-grid 25-kilowatt hybrid solar system to power auxiliary systems at that site. The site is located at 12,000 feet, so water stringing it or linking it to a grid is not feasible, and hauling diesel trucks periodically to refuel it was also not very cost-effective or had its own large footprint. So they opted for this option here. Very interesting, especially the hybrid solar system. We have a profile written up on it. If you go to gluon.org, very interesting option for remote locations or locations where there's no grid connectivity and we'd have to use diesel operators. The third one is this material and waste sites. This is a site in Georgia where they recycle concrete from the demolition debris on the site for that creek bed material to limit erosion. One of the things to point out here is that it takes participation by everybody to come up with some of these ideas, and sometimes the obstacles may be something that we don't necessarily control. So we have to open up that conversation about what BMPs may apply early on before we start working on the site. And the last option there is this constructed wetlands to manage stormwater and provide habitat. This is actually from one of the sites that you'll be hearing about, John Simons. But what I wanted to point out here as well is that often there are associated benefits from the implementation of BMPs like these, especially with respect to water, when it comes to climate change adaptation. In other words, there are lots of stormwater management BMPs that have a dual function as climate change adaptation to mitigate crests in stormwater flows. That's a whole different topic, but I did want to take the opportunity to highlight those that symbiosis is there. The question is, what BMPs would I use at my site? How do I know which ones are best? How do I know what options exist? Well, that's a question we started asking ourselves a long time ago, back in 2009, and following agency and actually federal government policy on standards, we opted to look for an opportunity to work with a standards development organization. We found there were lots of interested parties, including consultants, developers, state programs, site owners, et cetera. And we all together launched this effort back in 2009. So the standard guide was completed in 2013. It is owned by the ASTM standard, by ASTM. It's not owned by the agency or anybody else. There was a very open participation in its development. It was a very long process. In other webinars, you've heard folks describe it. It was painful, but it was necessary. In the end, we get a consensus standard, and we're happy to see it having been rolled out. It's intended to be a live document, and in fact, the first revision is in the works. I say completed. I'm not sure it's been released. We'll ask John or Deb for closer to it when we have a discussion later on as to the status. But the point is that it is being updated. This is a very short introduction to what it is because Deb is going to describe it in more detail. Some things to highlight, as I suggested, it codifies best practices and defines a process for identifying BMPs and reducing an environmental footprint. The original version had over 160 best management practices and outlined that process for the BMP application straight off the bat using a process that Deb will describe, or the option of doing a quantification to better identify which BMPs we want to focus on. That's what that little diagram is at the bottom. Once a project determines that they want to apply the standard guide, they can go straight, if it's a small, simple project, they can go straight through the BMP screening process and selection and implement the BMPs that apply. Or it's a more complex one, they might do a quantification, and based on the outcome of that, go to the BMP selection. Main point is it results in a transparent, documented process that is reported publicly, and we'll be talking more about the importance of having that documentation and to substantiate any statements about made about the implementation of the standard of the project. We want to go here very quickly to that concept of sustainability principles and cleanup programs. There's been a lot of discussion on this topic in multiple environments. And we want to put the concept of the standard guide within other efforts that we have in place in our different cleanup programs. In the case of the Superfund program, for example, a very important part of the social aspect, the social leg of sustainability, is engaging communities in site decisions. It's actually required by CERCLA, and we have a very active community involvement program with about 100 people across the EPA regions engaged in ensuring that the communities in the vicinity of contaminated site, Superfund sites, have an active say in the decision-making process. Of course, we're also preserving green space through reuse, making that land available for communities, and naturally, at the core driver of these cleanups, we're protecting human health and the environment. On the economic side of sustainability, of course, we're facilitating land reuse, which has a lot of implications for jobs, economic development, tax revenue, et cetera, providing direct employment opportunities to the cleanup itself, and then revitalizing local economies. Now, with the application of the standard guide, what we're looking at is reinforcing that peer environmental footprint of the work necessary to clean up the site. So minimizing diesel emissions, for example, minimizing the use of virgin material, promoting water efficiency, and all the other core elements, improvements on those core elements that result from the application of BMPs. So important, keep this in mind in the context of the triple bottom line and everything else that is going on to address those three pillars of sustainability. So in summary, we have seen great signs of progress since we set down this path in back in 2008. There have been significant policy developments in EPA and in other programs. As you know, shortly after the release of the ASTM standard guide, our assistant administrator in Oswer, who oversees all cleanup programs, issued the policy statement on encouraging the use, stating, as part of this policy, I recommend that regions and OSRA programs facilitate and encourage the use of ASTM standard guide for greener cleanups in your efforts to implement greener cleanup practices. And I think we are seeing that happen, and that's part of what the webinar is intended to cover today. So the tool itself, as I mentioned, was released in 2013. It's recently being updated, and that update will soon be posted. We'll go into that in a minute. With regard to the breadth, we know the ASTM standard guide is now in use at sites in all major U.S. cleanup programs, and today we're going to cover four of them. Experience, we're seeing a lot of consulting and engineering sector companies building greener cleanups into their operations and gaining experience applying the standard guide, and we'll hear from some of that today. drivers for the implementation of the standard guide, they are still out there and growing. Several executive orders, which we've covered previously, the EPA strategic plan going out through 2018, contracts and increasingly references to the standard guide in state cleanup programs, and we'll discuss those briefly at the end in our discussion session. As a result, we're seeing the application of greener cleanup best management practices at site cleanups and consequently cleanups with a lower environmental footprints. Gene, if there's one question that you think or that we should take at this point, we'll do it. Otherwise, we'll move on.
Okay, Carlos, we just had one brief question, and that one brief question was asking you to define the acronym SCR.
Oh, selective catalytic reduction. Thank you. That's a technology applied to diesel equipment to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions.
Okay. All right, I don't see any other questions in the queue, but we'll go ahead and move on to the next presentation. But we'll remind participants you can privately submit your comments and questions using that queue window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen.
Hey, Gene, thanks. Let's get going.
If you want to maximize.
Oh, sorry, a little technical difficulty. We're there. Okay, so I'm Deb Goldblum, and I initiate and lead, from the agency standpoint, the Greener Cleanup Standard Initiative. And as Carlos mentioned, we really kicked off with the ASTM in 2009. 2013, the standard came out, and we worked with industry to do that, to create the standard. And in the end, this is what it looks like. It supports the tenets of EPA's greener cleanup principles, meaning it is based on the core elements as its foundation. It's applicable to individual or multiple phases of cleanup, and by that I mean phases of cleanup. Every cleanup we do has sort of steps, from investigation to remedy selection to remedy implementation. So you could use it just on, for example, remedy implementation, or if you're at a tank site where you're going from the start to no further action fairly quickly, you might use it at multiple phases of your cleanup. It identifies and employs best management practices, and that's going to be the heart of the document. It offers an option for quantitative evaluation, and we've had webinars on quantitative evaluation. There are several tools out there, such as CIFA and SiteWise and SRT. They're footprinting tools. People are also using life cycle analysis to quantify footprint reductions. This offers that as an option to help you the decision process. And then it promotes transparency through a robust reporting structure, and that includes a self-certification, reporting of results across all the core elements, and public availability of the process and outcomes. But most importantly, and part of today's conversation, is that it works at any site. So it doesn't matter if it's a TSCA site, a Superfund site, a state site, a federal site, you can apply this standard. Let's talk about it. Going into this process, many of us never built a standard before. We learned a lot as we went along. First of all, ASTM has a set structure for any standard they create, issue. It sort of looks like this. The first four chapters are the scope and reference documents. And wait, we have a little issue here.
No, it's a survey.
There. Okay. First four chapters, the scope, reference documents, terminology, significance, and use. Okay, they're fairly administrative. Okay, you could probably read them once and never read them again. I'd say the biggest challenge we had was with terminology because, again, we had a diverse group working across a lot of different cleanup programs and defined terms that we felt were universal and intuitive and got beyond the cleanup jargon was a challenge, but I think we did it. Then the next four chapters are the protocol itself. We have planning and scoping, and it's really similar to any cleanup you do except with some minor additions. Section 6, which is the BMP process, and this can apply to any site. Then there's Section 7, which is the option for quantitative evaluation, and that's most appropriate at large or complex sites. And then Section 8 describes expectations for reporting. documentation reporting. So you need to not only document things, but you need to report them and make them publicly available. And then Section 9, keywords, but we can skip that. That's just an ASTM requirement. So next slide. After the standard itself, there are four appendices. X1 is supporting documentation, such as some references. X2 is the technical summary form. And what that does, it lays out all the reporting expectations that are described in Section 8 in a template. So you don't have to read to Section 8, you can just fill out the template. X3 is the BMP table. This is a tool. It's a table that lists over 160 best management practices. They are, when we were developing this, it became a little hard to manage. We realized we had to come up with something to help keep them organized in our head. So we came up with something called BMP categories. And they are, an example would be power and fuel, liquid and solid waste, sampling and analysis. So these are activity-based categories. It also has filters for remediation technologies, and it shows the outcome. It sort of checks off boxes to show you how those activities relate to core elements. And then X4 is supplemental information with regard to similarities and differences between doing environmental footprint and life cycle analysis. And we had industry experts in the field come and help write this section. It's really a great guidance document there. So we built the standard. We also built this technical summary form in the BMP table. But what we didn't realize is that ASTM only issues standards in PDFs, which made the technical summary form and the BMP table, this writable form, and the BMP table fairly useless. What we did learn is ASTM has something called adjuncts. So when they have components to a standard that are not in a PDF form, for the ASTM it's more like the coarseness of sandpaper, but it also could be an Excel table. They sell them separately or as in a package with the standard. So X2, the technical summary form, is an adjunct, and that makes it a writable PDF. And X3, the BMP table, if you want in the Excel format, then it's an adjunct, and you can be bought alone or with the standard. Let's get to the steps. So I said the heart of it is 5, 6, 7, 8. 5, planning and scoping. There's actually 9 steps in this, but we sort of chunk them into 3. First step, you're going to select the lead environmental professional, and we had to define that, and that's defined in the terminology section. And it's really based on the all appropriate inquiry 1527. That's an ASTM standard requirement that has a little bit more to it. You have to assemble your team, have to identify the regulatory program, and you should actually talk to your regulator right then and say, what are your expectations for greener cleanups? Step 2, or 4, 5, 6, you're going to compile your site data, you're going to identify your key stakeholders, you're going to develop a budget and schedule. It's what you do in any site. Hope. Step 3 is where it gets a little different. You're going to think about, okay, I got the standard, Sal. Which cleanup phases do I want to apply it? Do I want to use just BMPs, or do I want to incorporate a quantitative evaluation into the process? And how am I going to report my results and make them publicly available? All things you need to think about up front. I've mentioned cleanup phases a couple times. As a group, we came up, this was a lot of discussion. I have about 50 different versions of this slide in my computer about what are the appropriate names to describe universally the different cleanup phases for cleanups, remediation. So we have site assessment, we have remedy selection, we have remedy design / implementation, we have operation, maintenance, and monitoring, we have remedy optimization, and no further cleanup. Now we're going to add a little bit to that. We all decided, well, sometimes you might want to optimize a remedy. And sometimes that optimization meaning is just something like you're redesigning it. So maybe you're switching the well network. That's a remedy design implementation change. Or sometimes you're completely redoing the remedy. So you're going from dual-phase extraction to enhance bioremediation. So that's when you're selecting a new technology. But basically, the process is the same as a remedy selection. Now we're going to overlay the standard. And so in this figure, we're trying to provide some direction based on the collective experience of the task group of when it's most appropriate to use BMPs versus a quantitative evaluation. So, for example, we even piloted these on some sites. It was found that following the actual BMP process, the remedy selection phase was not very helpful, so we didn't list it there. It doesn't mean you can't do it. It's just that was the collective experience. And then, for example, doing quantitative evaluation and site assessment, generally not the most useful. So that's the purpose of this slide. But really, you could do BMPs or quantitative evaluation on any steps of the process if you like. Section 6. This is the one and only BMP process. There are 5 steps in this process. The first is the opportunity assessment. So you're at a certain phase of your site, you know, let's say remedy design, you're going to say, what BMPs are applicable given the conditions, given the site conceptual model, given the contaminants of the site, given the budget constraints. Then you look at, you're going to prioritize them based on solely environmental footprint reduction. So don't think about anything else. Say, here, these are all, this is what's applicable. I'm going to prioritize based on environmental benefits. And if you look on the right side of my slide, there's some little graphics there. And you'll see this gives people flexibility that can accommodate regional differences and stakeholder differences. So in one part, maybe the greatest environmental benefit has focuses particular emissions, and that's result of non-attainment areas. And then another area might be the water footprint might be the what's going to lead to prioritization. After that, you do BMP selection. Step 4 is BMP implementation, and step 5 is BMP documentation. So let's look at that more specifically. Here's a little slice of the BMP table. So it's Appendix X3. We want to do our screen. Just so if you, since you probably haven't seen it, the left side is the BMP category. So, for example, power and fuel is a category. I mentioned there are several other categories. I think there are 10 of them. And then there's the best management practice. You'll see they are related to things that are specifically having to do with a cleanup. We did not include things such as LED lighting or recycling paper, although they're very important environmentally important practices. The list got way too long, and we wanted to focus on just the cleanup. And then you'll see after that the core elements, energy, air, water, materials, and waste in line and ecosystems, and that tells you which core element you're affecting when you implement that BMP. And then you can't see them all, but there are actually a dozen remediation technologies, and there are checks and filters for those. So the first thing you do is you go through the BMPs, you create a list that are applicable to your site. And for example, if you have no buildings, you can skip that whole category, making it more efficient with your time. So now we're at step 1. We've looked at the table. We say, here's my list of BMPs. I did not write out the actual words. This is just a graphic to explain it. I have 5 BMPs. You're not limited to using the table. So, for example, you've worked on other sites. You're a smart consultant. You say, I have a great idea. You can add a BMP. Nothing's stopping you. So that's your list of applicable BMPs. You also need to add any BMPs that are required by law that has to be included. Step 2, prioritization. This is the step where you take the list of applicable BMPs and sort them based solely on anticipated environmental benefit. Okay, we're going to do more sorts later. So this decision is based on professional judgment. You don't have to quantify. You could. Those that are likely to have a minimal effect on the footprint are given lower priority. Those that are more important are higher on the list. So I go through them and I say, oh, BMP 1 high, 2 medium, high, low, medium. There, when I get done creating my list, if you're me, you would sort the list. So I put my highs at the top, the mediums at the bottom, the lows at the bottom. Mediums at the middle, the lows at the bottom. So that's my prioritization step. We go to step 3, BMP selection. So here, you're going to select the BMPs you can implement. And as Carlos mentioned, transparency is a big part of the standard. There's not always a right answer. What this does, it just helps people understand the thought process. So what it does is you can say, hey, this one's high, and I'm going to implement it. And this one, BM3, I'm not going to implement it because of cost. And BMP4, it may be low, but I'm implementing it because it's required by law. And BMP5, that's a low one, but it's not very effective. So I'm going to drop that out. So again, people understand the thought process behind the selection. Some people, we've seen doing this, may add a whole extra column saying, actually explaining more explicitly, like they were going to recycle scrap metal components from remediation projects, but then they find out there's no nearby facility, so that you could add more detail if you choose. So then you get in the field, and you were going to use a local driller because that has a lower environmental footprint. And then you find out that that local driller is not available, you know, because that's what happens sometimes. So there's our table again, step four, we're at BMP implementation, and BMP six, this BMP was the local driller. There goes away the check mark. And when I document what happened. And, you know, sometimes you go in the field and things just happen. So that's the five-step process for the BMP protocol. And it's different than just taking 3 BMPs off the list. It helps people think about the way they do their work. It helps people think about ideas they hadn't thought about. We've seen this. So it's a little bit more. Section 7 is the quantitative evaluation. I'm not going to go into that but a second for today, okay? It doesn't matter which tool you use out there in the world of tools, of footprinting tools and LCA. This just says all of them should have these 7 steps, which could be broken up into 3, a setup, a numbers crunch, and a result. We see the quantitative evaluation being most helpful to identify the largest contributors as you go through the process. So you say, where are my contributors? So it can help you prioritize BMPs. We also see it really helpful if you want to actually report out the metrics from your BMPs. What are the results? How many gallons of water do you reduce? And also, it's also good for finding hidden contributors. Anybody who's done any work with LCA, life cycle analysis, knows that sometimes you're sort of fooled. So you might think that energy is going to be really significant, and then you go do the footprint or the LCA, and you find out, yeah, energy was significant, but water was really significant, and I hadn't considered that. So that's the purpose of doing quantitative evaluation. Now we're going to get back to the protocol. So we said, we got Section 5, planning and scoping, Section 6, the BM pre-process, Section 7, quantitative evaluation, and 8 is documentation reporting. If you're just doing the BMP process, you skip Section 7, and you go right on to Section 8. For documentation and reporting, there are 2 steps. The first step is you document. You got to create BMP tables for each phase. So that's meaning you have your applicable BMPs, they're prioritized, you list what you're going to implement, and you're going to provide rationale for what didn't happen. Step 2 is reporting, and that's when you're going to make it publicly available. And now I'm going to talk about a little more specifically of the what, where, and whens of reporting. So first of all, this is what you're going to report. When you report out, you're going to report out the BMP summary tables and the quantitative evaluation report if you did a quantitative evaluation. You're going to have a technical summary, which all you got to do is fill out Appendix X2. And basically, there's really 2 parts of that. It has the general information, which is the site name and the location. And then it also has environmental status, such as current cleanup phase, contaminants at the site. And then you're also going to report footprint reductions across the core elements, and again, that can be qualitatively, it can be just the key aspects of all that work you did, and you're going to self-certify. So that's what you're going to make publicly available. Where are you going to do it? Well, you can do it at a public repository. You could post it on a website. You could submit it to a regulatory agency if you have their prior consent. But what we really want to encourage is that you post it on the ASTM website, and then we can post as many as we can there, and then everyone in the cleanup community can see everyone's work. It's free, and all you need to do is contact Kate Chalfin at the email address on this slide. And then there's the when, the award. Well, it's based on the needs of the user, any requirements you have or agreements with the regulatory program, or commitments to contractual agreements or with stakeholders. It recommends that you report the results after implementation because we'd like to see that the work was actually done, but it's not limited to that. It recognizes that sometimes there's a large time gap between a work plan and implementation. In that case, on the technical summary form, there's a space where it says evaluation only. So the result of this ASTM standard guide is we have a standard protocol that you can use or you can recommend to some a responsible party consultant, depending on where you fit in the cleanup community, to implement. We have a tool, and that's the BMP table, but it's also the standard itself. This prioritization step and the going through the process helps people think differently and recognize options to reduce the environmental footprint of the activities they implement. And it's a reference, so you can reference it in contracts, policy, and legal documents. And what this does, it defines greener cleanups, so we all know what it is instead of just a bunch of anecdotal stories. It provides a level playing field for those who are implementing greener cleanups, minimizing greenwashing. As I said, this is different than just taking 2-3 BMPs off a list and saying, I did a greener cleanup. This way we all know what we're talking about. And it promotes culture change, raising the quality of cleanups everywhere. So the standard, as Carla mentioned, is gaining traction across all the cleanup programs. It's being used nationally. There's interest internationally. And the idea is that it would be recognized as the standard for greener cleanups. And with that, I think we should go on to our next speaker, which is Michelle Mellon, who will talk about how it's being used in the different in the TSCA program. Unless you want to have questions, Carlos, did you want to?
No, there's a quick question for Dave. Yeah, we are running short on time, but if there's I'll leave it to you if you have identified a question. Otherwise, we move on to Michelle.
I say we move right on to Michelle, just in the interest of time. But we do have a few questions. We'll come back later on.
Okay, thank you. So I'm just going to dive right in and explain that. I'm having a little trouble with my clients. Okay, so my presentation is going to be in four parts. The first is why the Region 10 PCB program integrates greener cleanups, then how we actually complete that implementation, and then we'll dive into the guide a little bit and explain how you as a consultant or facility owner operator can actually use the guide. And then I'll give a couple of success stories in Region 10. So for why, I first want to explain that what I'm talking about here today are PCB approvals that we write for cleanup rather than some of the other approvals that we might write for storage and disposal sites. And EPA's goal for evaluating cleanups is to do so comprehensively, first to ensure that protection of human health and the environment is considered, and second to reduce the environmental footprint of any cleanup activity. And additionally, in our PCB regulations, we have a requirement for any risk-based cleanup that no unreasonable risk of harm to human health or the environment can exist in that cleanup. And we find that that extends to climate change and sustainability. So I'm just showing this graphic again. Deb already brought this up. I just want to show this again really quickly to demonstrate one way that the PCB program is distinguished from other cleanup programs. I've added this bracket to the right just to show where the PCB program is typically involved. Our involvement begins at the remedy selection and typically ends at operation and maintenance. The site assessment and remedy selection process is often completed by the facility with little to no involvement by EPA. So let's dive into the implementation process in Region 10. I saw in the polls that a lot of you work on federal cleanup programs, so you're probably aware that PCBs are managed under many different umbrellas, such as CERCLA or RCRA or TSCA. And what I'm talking about today are strictly those approvals that happen under TSCA. So our cleanups can take the cleanup sites where we've used the standard include three basic types, which if you have worked on TSCA cleanup sites, hopefully you're familiar with this terminology, self-implementing remediation waste sites, risk-based remediation waste sites, and alternate decontamination. So a typical scenario in Region 10 PCB program, like I mentioned earlier, is that the site owner-operator identifies PCBs on their facility property, and then they do some site assessment and characterization, select a remedy, and then prepare a work plan for cleaning it up and verifying that it's all removed, and then they submit that to EPA. So we then begin discussions with the facility or the consultant to discuss the technical issues and the compliance with the regulations. And at that point, we also bring up the standard guide for greener cleanups. And I would say that every time we've brought it up with facilities, we've had a positive reception. Some facilities have heard of the guide, but most have not, and none of them had previously implemented it. But we have not received any negative pushback to using the guide at our cleanups. And so far, we've only really required modification of the work plan for adherence to the regulations or to allow us to make a finding of no unreasonable risk based on technical issues. So we have not yet required the work plan to be modified to include greener cleanups, DMPs from the standard guide, but we do expect to move towards that in the future. So the next step after we've negotiated the work plan with the facility is to actually write our approval. And we've started writing a condition into our approval that requires the cleanups to submit, after the cleanup is completed, the facility should submit a cleanup completion report. And within that report, we require reporting in accordance with the standard guide. So let's dive in now to exactly how you use the standard guide. It's typically at this point after the approval is issued that a facility actually picks up the standard guide and attempts to find ways to implement some BMPs. And we're pushing hard to make that step happen sooner in the chain, but as it stands, it currently happens after the approval phase with the PCB cleanup just by the nature of the program. And through the polling, it looked like most of you are not really familiar with the guide. Hopefully Deb's presentation started to put you at ease with the idea that it's not really a daunting process. And I'll go through the steps of how we see it implemented here, because I really think that it is like hitting an easy button. The guide just shows you exactly what to do. So if we move on, I'm just going to quickly show you these two pages that Deb already showed you. But what I wanted to emphasize here was that kind of the heart of the document that you'll be using in Section 6 and 8 are really only four pages, so there really isn't an administrative burden here. When we look at the BMP table, as Deb already pointed out, there are the categories on the y-axis, the core elements on the x-axis, and also remediation technology on the x-axis. The selection process for identifying the BMPs in step one is pretty simple for a PCB site. For the site characterization phase, you would primarily scroll down in the table to the sampling and analysis category, and then pick BMPs that are within that category. For all other phases of the project, typically, on average, our PCB sites really only have one remediation technology that is widely implemented, which is to excavate and dispose. Certainly a few other technologies are applicable and have been used, but by and large, excavation is or demolition of a building are the primary technologies. So that makes picking the rest of the BMPs pretty simple. Here on this slide, I've just kind of zoomed in into the remediation technologies and rotated it for ease of reading. But what you would do is essentially go look in that column for excavation and surface restoration and scroll down in the table, picking any row that has an X in it. And that's step one. That's all of your applicable BMPs. Now, the authors of the standard guide, as Deb and Carlos both have already described, were really careful not to include standard practices. They wanted to stretch, you know, they wanted to focus this guide on best management practices for reducing environmental footprint. And what we're finding in the BMPs that facilities choose to implement is that a lot of these BMPs actually are becoming standard practice, such as having a no-idle policy. Other of these BMPs certainly are a stretch, such as using retrofitted engines, but they all qualify for step one. Following the guide through this process and picking every BMP that's applicable really does cause you to identify and prioritize all the applicable BMPs to ensure that they have a chance to be integrated into your cleanup action. I think Carlos was the one who mentioned that the later in the process you do this, the less likely you are to integrate some pretty meaningful best management practices. So the sooner you do this and the more thoroughly you implement step one through three, really, the better conversations you can have with either your client or your contractors during the scoping phase or even in later phases. And as I said, we expect to start seeing these three steps of identification, prioritization, and selection with rationale. We expect to start seeing them in the work plans that are submitted to us. Whoops. We have identified a number of BMPs that are common across all PCB cleanup sites that have completed this process in Region 10. And I'm not going to read all of these, but I will state kind of the obvious, if you're skimming over these, that they aren't really revolutionary. And that's really okay. You know, this concept of greener cleanups, sustainable cleanups, it doesn't have to be all solar panels and diesel retrofits. Just having things like implementing an idle reduction plan or using dedicated materials for sampling, it puts you on the path towards sustainability and puts you headed in the right direction. So step four, after you've identified, prioritized, and justified which actions you're going to apply, is to actually go ahead and implement them. And as Deb said, sometimes things happen in the field, and so we're not going to hold that against you, but we do expect it to be covered in the documentation process. So the documentation process is pretty simple for a PCB site because they're overall fairly simple types of cleanups. We expect that in the completion report, you will just simply note which BMPs that you selected for application at your site, which of those you actually implemented, and then put a notation by any that you were not able to implement with an explanation for why. So you may kind of be wondering at this point, is that really it? And the answer is yes. We don't require you to do anything like a life cycle assessment, and we don't require any sort of quantitative analysis. Although you or your client may want to see a quantitative analysis to know how much water you have saved on your project or how many pounds of CO2 were reduced from being emitted or how much money was saved during the project. At this point, though, for from the EPA Region 10 PCB program perspective, we are most interested in getting you to think about sustainable remediation choices and actually implementing them rather than doing these sort of calculations to prove that they improved your sustainability metrics. And as Dad mentioned, if you follow the protocol in the standard guide for reporting, then you can actually publish your report up on the ASTM website available to the public. And here in the state of Washington, the very first PCB cleanup site to be published on the ASTM website was the Boeing Company in Everett, Washington. And this was a very simple cleanup. It was just two small dig-and-haul excavations, but they were able to find a number of BMPs to implement and then report on. And now they have the first PCB site published on the ASTM website. So as I mentioned before, when I speak with facility owner operators or consultants, I have never received any negative feedback. All the conversations have been very positive. I think that this is because the guide is so simple to use that even though a facility, typically the people I speak to have never implemented the standard guide, but once they see it, they feel that it's pretty easy to use. And it's not an administrative burden or a financial burden. In fact, a lot of times they find that it saves them costs all down the line. And as I mentioned, a lot of these BMPs are standard practices that facilities are already implementing. So this reporting process also provides a recognition factor. So some of the success stories in Region 10 in our PCB program, in general, we started implementing greener cleanups in our approval process in April of 2014, and since then we have completed, or we have finalized 9 cleanup approvals with a condition to abide by the standard guide, and 5 of those sites have actually completed their cleanup and submitted their reports, including ASTM reporting. This has been completed at a number of different types of sites, everything from like the Boeing Everett small industrial land excavation up to federal sites or very remote and rural sites in the Aleutian Islands. We've done simple things like a tank decontamination to large abandoned landfills. So this really can be implemented anywhere. So what we see going forward in the Region 10 PCB program is that we are going to be taking a very close look at all of the BMPs that are implemented, that have been implemented at our cleanup sites, and we're developing a baseline of those BMPs. We're going to be sharing this baseline with facilities, and we expect to see it integrated into the work plans prior to approval. And then in addition to that, we're going to be encouraging the use of other less frequently used BMPs that are capable of being implemented at these sites, such as using biodiesel. We're also working on developing a national fact sheet with the help of other regional PCB programs and headquarters. And Region 10 is not alone. I believe we were the first region to begin implementing this in the PCB program, but there are many other PCB programs across the nation that are similarly implementing greener cleanup requirements into their cleanup approvals. And then looking beyond the standard guide, we're also planning to start evaluating our risk-based cleanup sites that intend to leave PCB waste behind. We are planning to evaluate those in terms of flood risk in regards to future climate change and trying to answer the question, can we find no unreasonable risk given climate change impacts on future flood risks for the area? And that concludes my presentation.
Excellent. Thank you, Michelle. That was right on. Jean, I'll hand it back to you if you see any questions that are specific to Michelle, and otherwise we'll move on.
Oh, we definitely have some questions, but I think in the interest of time, we'll probably move on to the next presentation, and we'll come back to some of these bigger topics that people are bringing up.
Okay, so we hand it to you, Beth. Are you ready?
Sure. Thank you.
Great. Coming up for you.
So my name is Beth Sheldrake, and I'm a manager in our Superfund program in Region 10. And so as a good compendium to the PCB cleanup program, we're going to talk a little bit about a specific implementation of the guide in the Superfund program here in Region 10 in the state of Oregon. So Carlos already spoke, spoke about you know, the policies and the executive orders that speak to greener cleanups, so I won't go into that. But Region 10, like all the other regions in the country, has what we call a clean and green policy. It was implemented in 2009, and it identifies points of departure around each of these core elements. And like I said, all the other regions do have some version of this, but they all have the same goals of reducing the environmental footprint. Up until the point that the ASTM guide became available, we relied on fact sheets and just quoting our clean and green policy in enforcement orders and records of decision. But we had some successes, but limited successes because, you know, people didn't know where to start, maybe grabbed a couple low-hanging fruit, but there wasn't a systematic process to walk through a rigorous evaluation of potential BMPs. So, you know, along with the ASTM guide, you know, EPA looked at how we could really, or EPA Region 10 looked at how we could really push implementation of greener cleanups in a more real way, and we really wanted to lead by example. And so while we encouraged the use of our clean and green policy on enforcement lead sites, we wanted to take a look at an EPA lead site where EPA is funding the cleanup and see how we could further both the U.S. the use of the ASTM guide and just implementation of more of the stretch BMPs. So in the site that Mike Miller is going to talk about, we talked about what are the different ways we could encourage that, and we looked at, you know, again, our historic policy of just referencing our clean and green policy in our contracted documents, our remedial design documents. We looked at EPA applying the guide and pre-identifying those BMPs and putting them as requirements in our remedial design and bid documents. We talked about asking bidders to identify those and then evaluating contract proposals partly based on how rigorous and they evaluated BMPs and were willing to implement them. And then we talked about, you know, after construction contracts were awarded, asking the successful construction company to then apply the guide. Ultimately, we decided the most enforceable way to really get some real changes in the approach to the cleanup was for EPA to apply the guide and integrate the BMPs we felt were most promising into our remedial design and bid documents. So, you know, I won't get into the guide because Deb did a really good job as well as Michelle in kind of walking through how you go through the assessment. But, you know, the first step is looking at, you know, what BMPs are applicable to the site. So we did that. And then we looked at the prioritization, and we focused on the high and medium priority BMPs, those that would have the largest environmental footprint reduction, and that were implementable. But some things that came out of that, like Deb said, you know, stuff happens. For example, use of biofuels was identified as something that would have a good footprint reduction because of the large amount of heavy equipment on this site, and in theory should be highly implementable. But this site is located in a relatively remote area of southwestern Oregon, and biofuels were not readily available. So that was something that was then ultimately eliminated. But there were other BMPs that
that we identified, and then we had an internal management level discussion because this was a cleanup that was led by EPA and funded by EPA, and while many BMPs actually reduce the cost of cleanups, as Michelle said, some have an increased cost. And for this project, one of the key things that you'll see in the case study is looking at the use of cleaner diesel technology, and there is a cost associated with that. And we made a conscious decision to push very specific and kind of stretch goals in that regard, recognizing that there would ultimately be a small increase in cost of the remediation. But we felt it was important to be in line with EPA policies and executive orders to lead by example in that way and show that it can be done. And the impacts in this small community we felt were worthwhile in reducing the air toxics from the diesel emissions from a lot of heavy equipment around the community. So with that, I will turn things over to Mike Miller with CDM Smith. CDM Smith is EPA's technical assistance contractor who assisted in developing the remedial design and will be overseeing the construction, helping EPA oversee the construction at the Northridge Estate site in Oregon.
Thank you, Beth, for that introduction and setup of the case study. The case study site is in South Central Oregon, just above the California line. It's, as Beth noted, it's rather remote. It's in a somewhat arid and elevated area. The site itself is a residential subdivision, which is 3 miles north of Klamath Falls, and it's actually considered part of the town limits, I guess. Now, just a moment. For some reason, my video feed disappeared. It's coming back. No. Gene, help.
Don't worry, we're calling up your materials again. Just bear with me if you guys can. If I could get the whoever's trying to help to stop helping, that would be excellent. And I will regain control and pull up the correct materials. So bear with me, everybody. I apologize for that very brief disruption, but I'm calling up that case study right now, Mike, and we should have that right back up on the screen.
Okay, I see it. I see it.
And there we go. I apologize for that disruption.
I think it was the terrorists. Okay. So I was just introducing the site, 3 miles north of Klamath Falls. If you look at a relief map, you can see that the site itself, and I'm looking for my pointer. There it is. The site itself, the residential subdivision, is in this area right here. Kind of on the side of this small mountain. Again, remote, and you can see why folks might be interested in moving into such a subdivision. It looks quite peaceful and in a nice natural setting. So the site history tells us why we're here in the first place. In the 1940s, this was the site of a military barracks, which was where Marines were brought who were suffering health problems from having been deployed in the tropics. So they were having various tropical type diseases and maladies. And somehow it seems a little ironic, actually. There, from a 1940s era building might very well have asbestos in it, and this one did, or this complex did. And much later, improper building demolition during the development of this residential area is what caused the problem. Rather than recognizing the asbestos as something that needed to be taken care of in a permanent way, there were waste piles, burial pits, and asbestos-containing materials ended up in the surface and subsurface of the area. In 1993, the developer began building houses, and by 1994, the first properties were sold to homeowners. By 2003, the first homeowner was doing some home improvement type work, digging, and hit an asbestos-covered pipe. And that triggered the first emergency response from EPA, and then many emergency responses followed because after discovering the problem coming to folks' attention, it continued to come to people's attention simply by the frost, natural frost heaving and erosion in the area continued to bring the materials to the surface. So emergency responses were not a permanent solution, and it was recognized that there were about 300,000 cubic yards of asbestos-contaminated soil still present. So it's now in the Superfund program. The remedial action objectives were pretty simple: to mitigate direct contact and inhalation of asbestos fibers, and to control the migration and further spread of the asbestos. After going through the remedy selection process, the following was selected: excavation and consolidated of all the asbestos materials in on-site repositories, thorough cleaning of building interiors, and here we're talking about houses in the housing development, and post-excavation capping. Now note that some houses had to be demolished and others could be saved. So, again, this case study is to talk about the best management practice process. So selection of the best management practices, in fact, is the process here. We start by recognizing the purpose. The use of this process is to minimize the impacts of the cleanup activities themselves. And as earlier speakers noted, there are over 160 best management practices in the ASTM standard appendix. You screen them, or you go through them and look for what's applicable to your case. In our case, there were about 30 BMPs that applied to this asbestos dig and haul project. And particularly, they hit on equipment and fuel use and materials use for the project. And then continuing to go through the screening with all the, you know, is it implementable, is it high priority or low priority, is it something that simply can't be done, is it an easy hit, we ended up with a total of 16 final BMPs for incorporation into the remedial design. So in continuing to understand how we selected the appropriate BMPs, the first thing that you want to do in order to begin the narrow down process is to figure out remedy implementation. What are the greatest impacts to the environment from that process? And it was clear that fuel consumption was number one from both the earth moving equipment and transportation. And then followed by material use. And there were a lot of processes involved there, including backfilling, after excavation, capping, revegetation, using equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And also site preparation fit in there. But in a way, really, site preparation could even be considered in this case as a subcategory of material use. So again, let's hit the hard hitter first, and that would be fuel use, vehicles. So I'm going to give the briefest of introductions to EPA's off-highway emission standards. Very brief, not intended to be exhaustive. These standards are for off-road equipment, mostly things like the excavators and earth movers on the site. So if you look at the square graphic here, EPA came up first in 2000 with a Tier 1 off-highway emission standard. And this graph is NOx emissions on the Y and particulate matter emissions on the X-axis. And as the years went by, 2000 is Tier 1, 2006 Tier 2 was implemented, the idea was to shrink back the NOx and particulate matter emissions with the new standards. Then if you look off over to the right, sulfur emissions were also considered but not as formally as in the graph, but it's all part of the mix. So by 2007, we had Tier 4i, and by this year, we had Tier 4, which is the most stringent of all. So you see we're going in the direction of dialing down the emissions. So in a little bit of a feel for this figure informs the next slide here. So again, for the non-road construction equipment, such as excavators, these tenets were decided for the remedy. First of all engines must meet at least the EPA Tier 2 non-road emission standards. So they all have to be capable of that minimal emissions reduction from how emitting things could be. Furthermore, during year one of the project, at least 25% of the equipment must meet the more stringent Tier 4 standards or be retrofitted for an 85% reduction in particulate matter emissions. And then in years two and three, the same strictures apply, but to at least 50% of the equipment. And then after year three is the end of the project. Furthermore, for on-road vehicles, so that's really the transportation, at least 90% of the diesel on-road vehicles had to either have engines that meet the EPA 2007 on-road emission standards, or again, emission control technology be applied to reduce PM emissions by at least 85%. And you'll see this last one a lot because it's easy and very effective. And that, again, is an idling reduction plan for all diesel vehicles. If you're not using it, turn it off. So I'm going to show three tables now that summarize additional BMPs. And these tables are arranged for quick inspection to give the BMP itself from the standard, and then how that BMP translates into an implementable action in the design, and finally, how you might measure implementation and success, which is important for the reporting step. So first, we'll talk about materials, and I'm just going to breeze through these and not talk about all the details on each, but if you have questions, we can discuss these later. Use of recycled content. So the way that's done on site in particular was, you'll remember that the site started out as a barracks. The foundations of those barracks remained, and they weren't asbestos reinforced barracks or anything like that, so it really was truly concrete. That concrete is to be crushed, and the crushed foundation is used as a marker barrier to show the borderline between an on-site old repository at depth and the clean fill above it. So a beneficial reuse of a material already present on site. You don't have to bring in something else to achieve that particular end. Other things like using biodegradable recycled seed matting, that was easy. There was local straw available for reseeding after capping. Using compost instead of fertilizers, pretty obvious, as well as the benefits being obvious. And using equipment and products that can be reused or recycled, it's basically a simple decision in the design and equipment selection process. Moving on to another category, site preparation and land restoration, some of these are very ecologically oriented. Revegetate quickly and with native species. This is, again, after the capping is finished. And the best way to do that, taking into account the local environment, is both, and it really these two are in a way together, using native seed mixtures and planting at the end of each field season, which is when the plants would naturally be reseeding anyway. And the reason nature has it happening that way is that's when the rains start, such that the seeds can germinate. So it all makes sense. It fits in with the ecology, and it is the same ecology being preserved. Other simple hits include using nearby sources of backfill, and in fact, there were two identified within at most 3 miles of the site. Two more BMPs to round out this list, reuse existing buildings. It was possible to use one of the abandoned houses for office space and storage for the project itself, and redevelopment also including cleaning and reselling abandoned houses as much as possible, and recycle reuse of any recovered materials, including trees that had to be removed from the site, although the bark first had to be tested for asbestos fibers, and as long as that was absent, the tree wood itself could be reused, usually chipped, and used for uses that employ wood chips. So I can conclude then. First, we recognize the benefits of environmental footprint reduction, and in some cases, one might do a footprint evaluation. In other cases, maybe not. In the case of this site, it wasn't strictly necessary because these benefits were pretty obvious. You could go through basically, what are we doing on this project? What are the steps? And it was pretty easy to figure where the biggest hits were going to be coming in. Next step is to review the entire BMP list and then right away narrow down on the elements that are most applicable and most effective to the project. And in this way, we shrink the remedies footprint and do something good for the project, for the environment, and for the economy of the project, because almost every one of these BMPs save money. And I will remember that Beth noted that EPA thought that it was worth the investment to go with the cleaner diesel application, and that's going to be a project-specific decision that each team makes for their project. And finally, just a little bit of a warning that one or two BMPs don't necessarily make your remediation project green. So for example, everybody's favorite, I'm going to print all of my reports two-sided and thus use less paper, and I'm happy I can go home and sleep at night. That is not fair. Picking one thing and the easiest thing you can possibly do and probably something that you were going to do anyway and something involved only in office work doesn't really give you a green remediation. In our work, we so often see the discussion of a project or a product, and the statement is made that this is green, and that's it. Why is it green? Why do you think it's green? What makes it green? What did you do? None of that's there, but if you do a BMP evaluation and you document it, it's all there. You can see why it's green. You can see what's green. The proof is in the reporting. And that's all I have.
Great. Thank you very much, Mike. And partially due to my fault, we are getting a little bit squeezed on time. So I'm going to go ahead and ask that we hold questions, Gene, and for the discussion at the end, we do want to hear from Leanne, from John. So Leanne, if you're ready, and while Gene brings up your presentation, I'll hand it over to you.
Can everybody hear me?
Very well.
Hello? Yes? Yep. That'll be great. All right, hello, everybody. My name is Leanne Thomas-Foster. I'm from the Public Building Commission of Chicago. And here, the next thing. So I'm here to walk through a case study related to our integrated development program that we say moves beyond the dig and haul. And we are the City of Chicago's building and development arm, and we typically conduct projects in excess of $2 million annually. And I'll briefly go through two things that I think you should know is that the PBC, in our mission statement, we state that the PBC designs and builds facilities that reflect the highest standards of environmental and economic sustainability. And our vision also incorporates a building environment in which function, beauty, and sustainability are inherent in every community. So it's basically the core mission of what we do on behalf of the City of Chicago. And our green sustainable remediation efforts do fall in line with the City of Chicago's 2015 Sustainable Chicago Agenda. And as you can see, throughout the years, the City of Chicago has been very green sustainable forward since 2000 with the starting of its green medians. All right. Generally, I'll briefly go through this, and this is our general economic sustainability. So in general, 1 year we pulled out, 2013, we were able to build $32.9 million of projects on behalf of the City of Chicago and created 1,744 full-time equivalent jobs And we also established community hiring programs for each one of those projects of which we partook in. Our environmental sustainability, since 2008 is our aggregate, we do have 88 LEED targeted buildings as well as 70 certified buildings as well. And we've been able to establish over 23 million gallons a year in potable water savings and 1.49 million in energy savings. And we've also recycled over $67.6 million worth of recycled materials to date. And we also use $117 million worth of regional materials. And we've diverted over 195,000 tons of materials from a landfill to date. So our goal generally is to repurpose impacted sites into sustainably designed new civic anchors, and we save resources in the project process. And how we do this generally is through starting, as everybody's discussed earlier, we look very early in the planning process to engage our stakeholders, our environmental design consultants, and we sit down and use our synergies to sit and coordinate not only the future uses of the site, but then also the remediation efforts that need to take place and see how we can best remediate that site with a minimal impact to the environment. And also results in cost savings. It aligns with our green agendas. And we also work towards equally protective remedies as well. For example, we may utilize a stormwater storage at a remediation cut, or we may use paved features such as tennis courts or engineered as our engineered barriers in the future. And then we do carry a lot of the sustainable practices through design and implementation as well. In terms of our general program level standards, we do have processes, procedures, and standards that originated in 2008. And we integrated in sustainable practices in terms of environmental into our contracts, our contract documents, our specifications. We even generated reporting tools and metrics and feedbacks and lessons learned back before the CIFA guidelines and before the ASTM practices came into place. And our goals for every project always align with the goals of our clients as well as our team. And we work towards resource savings, reducing environmental impact, making sure we have great health and quality of life on the projects of which we build. We also track metrics in terms of LEED, and we also have conducted a CIFA analysis on one of our projects, of which I'll present later. And we do tend to try to generate positive messaging in turning brownfields over to our communities within the city of Chicago. And you'll see on the right, just generally spec'd where all of our projects have been throughout the city of Chicago in the last 8 years. Okay, so the first two projects I'm going to be talking about today are Back of the Yards College Preparatory High School, and I'm also going to be talking about Whitney Young Library adjacent site. And then, Jean, where's the green arrow? Not seeing it. Oh, there it is. Thank you very much. Okay, very good. Thank you. So the first project I'm going to talk about is at Back of the Yards, and it's located in the southwest side of the city of Chicago. We completed this in project in summer of 2013. It's a CPS urban model high school, and it serves over 1,200 students. It's a 212,000 square foot building, and it's a three-story building plus a lower level, and it also has a super huge swimming pool in the basement. It's an 8.82-acre site, and it also received LEED Gold certification, and we received several awards, as you're going to see, and then one of which I'm very proud of is the 2014 National Association of Environmental Excellence Awards for Environmental Stewardship. Okay. So over here on the right, you're going to see a photo of one of the green remediation strategies that we'd undertaken on the site. That was the reuse of pool clay spoils to cap the entire site, and I'll be talking about that a little bit further, but I wanted you to take a general look at that because that's about 20 feet below grade. We also conducted in-situ treatment of hazardous waste lead contaminated soils as well. This particular site did not have any US EPA or Illinois funding associated with it, but we did utilize green remediation as a cost-saving strategy for the site. This site here, this is 47th Street. This is a very busy street. This is heavily residential here on the west side. To the east is a railroad yard, and then to the north is manufacturing. As you'll see here on the west side of the property, this is a very huge high school, and where that photo was taken was right in here where we actually have a high school swimming pool. And then you'll see this is the softball field. There's a lot of berming going on right here, a lot of berming along the perimeter of the building, as well as this football field. And there's also some bleachers along this line. And this whole area here has been built up about 5 feet above grade. The green remediation strategies that we utilize, we saved $33,000 for the in-situ treatment of hazardous waste lead. We diverted over 355 cubic yards of material from a landfill, and the in-situ treatment rendered that material inert, lowered the environmental burden, and eliminated the need to move hazardous materials around the site and off the site and through the community. It also allowed for the use of a local landfill, which is a Subtitle D facility, which was within an hour of this location versus the Subtitle D landfill facility, which would have taken us entirely across the country in order to dispose of it. And then the other remedy that we have here is the reuse of the clay spoils. So the cost savings to the project for this was $1.1 million. We were able to divert over 20,000 cubic yards of material from a landfill. And so as far as the strategies go, we called it the material reuse on site, soil management. It reduced the cost for disposal, and then also reduced the costs and the trucking for importing clean fill by 3,676 were eliminated, as well as the volume of the stone that didn't have to be brought into the site from a virgin quarry. As far as the benefits on this particular project, we have cost savings reduced and no hazardous material to the landfill. We reduced bringing in the new materials, as I just discussed. We also had community benefits here, which eliminated the risk associated with moving these hazardous materials, as well as any type of landfill materials and hard trucks through that neighborhood, of which I showed you on the west side was the main exit route for that particular site. We minimized traffic congestion and community disruption, and we also created a new high-performing high school with a co-located library branch there as well. And that particular facility once was an auto repair facility combined with an auto parts salvage yard, which had an earth floor. So you can even imagine the excitement in the community once that was changed. We also have reduced energy and reduced energy use and associated air pollutants, including greenhouse gas reduction from truck usage. We used a local landfill, as we talked about earlier. We reduced haul-off and imported virgin material use. We used a local laboratory for frequent confirmation samples, and we also used a local labor pool, not only with the environmental consultants that we used on site, but the contractors as well, and then local materials that actually helped build that particular high school. We also had generated an on-site stormwater management a section of the site that you saw underneath the football field, which actually has the ability to hold 1.4 million gallons of water per year. And we've been having an increase of these 500-year storms, so it really takes off that burden off of our combined stormwater system here. We also, again, waste materials management minimized imported and virgin material use, and we reduced the landfill impact as well. And we, as far as the land and ecosystem management, we lowered the environmental burden. We rendered that lead, hazardous waste lead, inert, so that wasn't being transferred to another area and being a continued burden for infinity. And then we also managed through the reuse of the use of clay and also native stone that was on site from a beginning part of the project, and we had reused that same stone again everywhere we could underneath any hardscape surfaces. As far as the ancillary benefits of this project that started in 2008 and ended in 2013 is it actually informed and helped us establish a PVC program level guidelines and best management practices before the ASTM standards came out. We developed our own environmental design guidelines for all of our environmental consultants, and we also established soil management plans that they were required to do. It was in all of the task orders for our environmental consultants to try to find the most ingenious ways to minimize the impact to the site and to the environment. And then we also took it a step further and templated specifications associated with that same program. We also established this integrative team sitting approach where we brought an environmental design team on very early in with the civil engineers, with the landscape engineers and structural engineers, and we engaged our stakeholders early as far as moving some things and items around on the site so that we could minimize taking materials off the site. And we started really thinking in 3D early so that we can begin design process as soon as possible. And it was very much aligned with the Illinois PA Green Remediation Guidelines. The next project I wanted to speak with you about today is a case study, is Whitney Young Branch Library. This is located on the southeast side of the city of Chicago. There's an adjacent parcel next to an existing library. It's located at 415 to 423 East 79th Street. We completed the site in summer of 2014. And this was a cleanup of a former dry cleaner in preparation for future land development there. Property size is 0.8 acres, and this site also contributed in us getting a 2014 National Association of Environmental Professionals Environmental Excellence Award for Environmental Stewardship. What you're going to see below here, this is a picture of a trench box, and then we are adding in some sodium permanganate material into an actual undercut. And then you will also see to the right here is a sort of a mixing, if you will, below grade of that said material into the soil. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. So in general, the history of this site, it was once a former dry cleaner. It was only a dry cleaner for 1 year in 1986. And surprisingly, we had quite an extensive environmental history on the site. We had tetrachloroethylene in excess of 300 parts per million, up to 1,200 parts per million throughout the site. And it was in all stratas of soil. It started from grade all the way down to 19 feet deep. As far as the funding history, which is interesting, this is our first Illinois EPA revolving loan fund, and we received $436,000 as well as $600,000. We went out for three separate grants because there were three separate parcels here, and we were awarded all three, so we had $600,000 of that. And we had utilized that revolving loan funding for the IEPA green remediation study. And interestingly enough, we were working towards putting together some type of guideline using this project as a study, and it turned out at the same time the ASTM standards were in draft form. So as opposed to us creating our own standard, we began using the ASTM standard and used that as our guideline throughout the process. And at this particular project, we conducted a in situ remediation that included, and you'll see it a little bit later in some photos, it included us adding sodium permanganate in order to remediate the site below grade. We also conducted a pilot study on the site as well, of which the US EPA Brownfields grant funding paid for, and it was to help us decide what would be the correct oxidizer for the remediation of which was going to take place. So in general, it's hard to see this slide. You'll see we have, let's see here, on the north side, this is 79th Street. It's a fairly busy street in the city of Chicago, as well as Martin Luther King Drive. Here's an existing library here on the west side, as well as this is our remediation site as well, and this is Vernon Avenue. This is all in this area here is all residential, and you can't necessarily see it on this plan, but I wanted you to get generally familiarized with the site. And then on this bottom portion, I'll talk to you a little bit about later, but it's the actual cross-section of the remediation that took place. Okay, so in terms of this particular site, again, there's a green remediation evaluation that took place using the funding from the Illinois EPA. We followed the ASTM guidance for greener cleanups, and the IEPA currently uses the results as a case study. The in-situ treatment of tetrachloroethylene was treated with sodium permanganate, and the total cost savings was $1.25 million from a traditional cleanup to the cleanup that had taken place. And in the state of Illinois, the cleanup for the volumes of chemical that we had below grade is typically a 10-foot undercut for an inhalation exceedance that exceeds a certain threshold of ours. I think it was 13 parts per million, and ours, of course, had 100 times fold that, so that wasn't going to work. So we had came up with an alternate strategy. And through this alternate strategy, we were able to defer 22,000 cubic yards of material from the landfill, and we utilized the in-situ treatment that rendered the material inert. We also allowed the materials to be kept in place. We also planned for future development and stormwater storage on the site while we were installing our caps as well. And then as far as any of the technologies for site assessment as well as assessment during the actual remediation itself, we used direct push technologies because of the sensitivity of the perimeter surroundings and the people of which live close by. As far as the benefits go, the cost savings were exceptional. We already had talked about that, and we had also been able to get access to those additional funding streams thanks to the Illinois EPA and the US EPA. There was a community benefit. We deactivated a tetrachloroethylene plume that was fairly significant below grade. We eliminated risks associated with moving the hazardous materials from the site through the community and through on our streets to a landfill. We minimized traffic congestion and community disruption. We also reduced energy use and associated air pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions. We ended up using a local landfill as well and laboratory, and we minimized our impacts from transportation. We reduced haul-off and import of clean material, and we eliminated over, as a total on the project, 4,043 trucks from the street. As far as the water resource impacts, we integrated an on-site stormwater management plan into the final design for whoever the future developer is, so they don't have to breach the existing cap. And then we also had a waste and materials management component where we minimized imported virgin material from local quarries. We also reduced the landfill impact, and we diverted 480 tons of concrete from below grade from a landfill to a recycling. And then as far as the land and ecosystem management, again, we rendered that same material that we talked about earlier, that tetrachloroethylene inert, which has a lower environmental burden long-term on our aquifers. And the site is ultimately ready for site development once the city chooses to sell that parcel of land. So as far as the target treatment zones, what we had done is we performed a pilot study where we had gone across the site in a grid-like pattern. And first we had gone through and identified horizontally and vertically the stratas of which the environmental contamination existed, so that we only needed to treat those specific zones relative to tetrachloroethylene. And secondly, we conducted a pilot study in very high-level areas on the site to see how well sodium permanganate would work. And then from that point, we instilled a hot spot remediation of that said sodium permanganate at a very deep level. And what we had done is we had dug down in certain hot spot areas on the site down to with the trench boxes that you saw in the earlier photo, and we had remediated in place, mixed that material, and then backfilled it to a 95% compaction. And then we installed an engineered barrier that is only 3 feet, and the requirement in the state of Illinois is 10. We were able to find an impermeable clay that met the certain risk assessment requirements, and we were able to get that passed. And then we also added in geomembrane and clay layer in, and we added in compacted stone layer to grade of CA6 once we were finished. And here are the 3 treatment areas that we ended up concluding were the highest levels that we ended up treating with the sodium permanganate. And then it's very difficult to see here, but there is a clean compacted layer of clay here and a geotextile that's here, and we also installed the stormwater system and the sewer in below that so that there's no penetration within that at a later date for future developers.
I might ask you to try to go through a little bit quickly. We're running really short on time, so if you might be able to skip forward a bit. Thank you.
I will. I'll go as fast as I can here. All right, so we conducted a CEFA analysis, the USEPA CEFA analysis, which is a spreadsheet for environmental footprint analysis, and we just wanted to show that the remediation does pay off environmentally as well as financially. So realistically, we were able to reduce the revolving loan principal by 30% of the initial loan based on doing this. And because of this new greener remediation technology, we were able to reduce the total energy usage in BTUs by 56%, total nitrogen oxides by 59%, total sulfur oxides by 52%, total particulate matter from 60%, hazardous pollutants by 61%, and total greenhouse gases by 55%. And that is the difference between doing an in-situ chemical oxidation cleanup versus, and then also the installation of the 3-foot engineered barrier versus an actual 10-foot cleanup that required supposed trench boxes that would have been sheet pile walls. So the bottom line, I think I'll move a little forward, is there's IEPA goals and there's also PBC program goals. And our goals basically were to provide these case studies to anybody that we can to show that there is an ability to push to deeper levels of BMPs. It's a model for local government adoption in terms of the new ASTM standard, and it provides precedent that others can access fairly readily. There's some very user-friendly green tools that are out there. The ASTM standard for greener cleanups, as we've been discussing, is well vetted. It's transparent and defensible, and there's no greenwashing associated with that. So I just also wanted to mention that greener cleanup does not mean a less protective cleanup, and that you can't use a greener cleanup to justify a lesser remedy. And so you still want to look for no further remediation letters or no further action or whatever the other states are calling it. And the application's voluntary, funding opportunities from the state and the feds are available, and the cost-saving benefits are endless. And so I'll wrap it up by saying it's a critical time in our lives and careers where we need to exercise energies towards the sustainability of our planet. And what will you do? And if you have any questions, I can answer them later. Thank you.
Much appreciated, Leanne. Thank you very much. I did see a couple of questions very specific to you. But we want to give John a chance to cover the project he worked on in Connecticut. And so we'll hand it over to him. And then for those of you who can hang in there, we'll try to get to some of the questions, but it may be after the two-hour slot we had reserved. Thank you. John?
Okay. Thanks, Carlos. I will go as quickly as possible. This is an interesting case study of a large out-of-service chemical manufacturing facility. And actually, I can go through this slide just quickly. I'm going to just basically give you a little bit of the history of the project and how we went through the BMP evaluation process and what sort of notable environmental, social, and economic BMPs that were identified. Here's a project overview. Where's the green arrow, Gene?
Gene, could you give us the arrow?
Okay. All right. So this site is basically divided into two sides. This side, the former manufacturing facility, is contaminated with Dean apples, and this portion of the site had some large waste piles that were the result of wastewater treatment, basically sludge. So they have piles of wastewater treatment plant residuals. Then there was some contaminated wetlands and contaminated groundwater that was controlled by a groundwater treatment system that was put in as an interim remedial measure. When the client acquired the site, there was some local issues associated with the public because the project had been stalled. The company actually had acquired the site through a corporate acquisition, and they engaged a consulting firm skilled in community relations to engage the community. That firm developed a project website. They made sure the client and their consultants worked with the town council and then the community advisory panel, and then actually involved the community in the remedy selection, and that resulted in the EPA ultimately recognizing some community members that put a lot of effort into the overall remedy with some awards. They implemented a community relationship plan, and the end result was a stakeholder-driven reuse planning process for both commercial and ecological areas, which I will get into in a moment. So the remedial strategy was this groundwater treatment system, which was combined with a low impermeable wall, which was located close to this river. And what the green remediation best management practice here was, and this is a great example, is they actually cycled the groundwater treatment system pumps based on the tidal elevation of the river, which had substantial energy savings and also groundwater extraction savings. They consolidated the wastewater treatment plant residuals on site in consolidation cells. They did sediment removal. They did in-situ thermal treatment for Dean apple and a protective cover system to eventually do redevelopment on this portion of the site. And this portion of the site. And this portion of the site was destined, based on community input, for ecological enhancements. And this is actually a graphic rendering that was made to show the stakeholders what the remedy could look like. And here we see wetlands, walking trails, ecological habitat for restoration. It was actually a great combination of two different aspects of remedies. So my firm got involved when we were retained to actually do a retrospective review of a considerable amount of green remediation consideration for this project, and we did it on several different aspects of the project, which demonstrates how the standard can be used for various aspects of remedies. And then we also included the social aspects and economic aspects for this specific project. So step one was the BMP opportunity assessment, where we actually looked at each aspect of the remedy. In step two, we prioritized BMPs, and we did this, if you can see, here we've got two columns that were added to the BMP table, one for priority and one for retain. And that's to help facilitate the BMP prioritization process in step two. Step three was remedy selection. Here you can see we added a column for comments to the BMP table. Then we used professional judgment to identify BMPs. We checked the table with selected BMPs. We sorted the table by priority and whether they were retained. And then we repeated that for each aspect of the remedy, as I showed you earlier. So there was about seven different aspects. Then we determined in step four which BMPs could be or were applied, and we documented why BMPs retained from step three were not implemented. And then we prepared a report in accordance with Section A of the ASTM Greener Cleanup Standard, which involved preparing a technical summary format report. We had over 75 environmental BMPs in this project. Now, given this was an atypical project with lots of opportunity to implement BMPs, and we had a very motivated client who actually implemented some BMPs that actually may have cost money, and that is allowed under the standard. Under the standard, we can eliminate BMPs if they're too costly, or at the client's prerogative, if they want to spend a little bit extra money to make the project greener, that is perfectly fine, and it's in concert with the standard. Some other notable BMPs, we'll go through these quickly. We created on-site wetlands. We utilized blast furnace slag for the hydraulic barrier wall construction. And the blast furnace slag was a recycled material. It was mixed with Portland cement, recycling otherwise what would be deemed a waste material. I mentioned that. We selected revegetation, or it was selected, that required minimal mowing. They managed drilling waste on-site under CAPS. And they used a field screening or triad approach involving DNEPL dyes to control the investigation process real-time. The in-situ thermal treatment had 15 BMPs just for that aspect of the remedy alone. Insulated piping, recovering electrodes, using local labor and labs when possible, employing variable frequency drives, all great examples of green BMPs that can be implemented. And then this project, as I mentioned, had social BMPs, which we tracked, and this demonstrates the flexibility of the standard. We basically took the same Excel table, we listed social and economic BMPs, we sorted them, we prioritized them, we sorted them, and then we ranked them and we determined if they were implemented or not. And some of these economic BMPs, for the sake of time, I'm going to move pretty quick, but one of the most fascinating BMP I've ever seen used on a project is they actually had a web-based form that a local vendor could go in and fill out that would be transferred to the client's project management system. They would review what local vendors were available, and then they were able to use this tool to select local vendors for some of the products and services that were used at the cleanup. So this project promoted an economical yet green BMPs. Many of the BMPs saved money, some a significant amount of money. The GSR benefit included shifting the media and public perception from a negative to a positive. They improved corporate responsibility and made the community more supportive of the cleanup. They created local jobs. The community can now utilize ecological resources through these walking trails on the property, which was one of their desired outcomes of the stakeholder-driven process. And they enhanced regulatory acceptance of the overall remedy because the EPA was engaged and the stakeholders and community were engaged. And then the stakeholders can now showcase their success. And with that, if you have any questions, feel free to either email Gene or email me directly at jsimon@narusllc.com, G-N-A-R-U-S-L-L-C.com. Thank you very much. It leaves us possibly a couple minutes for questions.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. And again, thanks, everybody, for hanging in there. We were very ambitious with our agenda. I think we got quite a bit in. For those of you who can hang around, we'll have just a short discussion now. Maybe a couple of the questions that were lined up. I saw some of them were quite specific. I think there was one here, and it relates to Leanne. If you're still there, Leanne, what in-situ treatment was used for the lead? Okay,
and Leanne, you may need to come off of mute. That question is directed at you. All right, maybe we move on, Carlos, to another one.
Okay. If you don't mind, Jean, I'll allow you to scroll through those and pick some out. And I'm going to go ahead and talk to the responses we got from the participant poll online. First, I appreciate everybody's engagement in this part here. This is a series of questions that will help us gauge where things are, where we need to focus our efforts going forward. But there is, first I wanted to mention, there are quite a few things going on already. We've been doing some work with states, and I know there have been some developments in states, and I thought, Deb, in that general area, is there anything that you could highlight with respect to the states and the ASTM standard guide?
Well, I like the poll. You see, are you familiar with greener cleanups? And you see, I see 37% yes and 47.1% somewhat. I mean, what we're seeing is that there continues to be traction, but we think we also need to do a lot of training, and we are doing training. So we are out at national conferences, but we've also done training in the regions in 1 and 5 and 7 recently, and the states come in. Recently, we were in Connecticut, and we're in Virginia. And the states are stepping up in that, for example, I know at least 5 states had the ASTM standard on their website. 2 states call for reporting footprint reduction as part of their cleanup program, and Massachusetts policy strongly encourages use of the standard to meet regulatory requirement. So states are stepping up, EPA is stepping up, and actually consultants are stepping up. If you search the web, you'll start seeing consultants are saying, you know, we use the ASTM standard. So it's out there.
Great. Thanks, Ed. Yeah, one of the questions we had was, what line of work you as a participant are generally engaged in. And looking at that, it seems to be pretty evenly distributed between federal and state or both, maybe a little bit more leverage toward the federal level. And there's quite a few responses there. I'd say, let's see, 30 plus 50, about 70 responses. That's the line of work you're in. With respect to have you applied the standards guide, there we had a 14. So clearly, there is ground to cover there, and that's one of the reasons, not that everybody's going to be applying the standard guide at every site, but we think there are still opportunities out there. Today we heard from speakers working in 4 different programs, so there's definitely opportunity in all of them, and I think there's still opportunity for folks to apply the standard guide at more sites across all programs. As we mentioned, the guide was intended to be live. We're learning a lot as we go forward, especially now that we're starting to get the written reports from the application of the standard. That's one of the questions I have for John, if you have any insights as to, so I mentioned I knew there was some work going on with respect to the guide, the first, I guess, revisit of the guide since it was released in November of 2013, I believe it was. Are there any updates you can share with us?
Yeah, so I'm the ASTM task group lead for the Greener Cleanup Standard, and we spent the last year actually updating the guide, rebalancing it, and we made a few editorial changes throughout the document. We really scrubbed the BMP table to ensure that there's only one action or activity for each BMP that was listed. And we can expect the new guide, which will be E2893-15, to be published and made available for, I guess, purchase from ASTM right around December 1st, so just about 2 weeks from now, where we're going through our very final review of the guide. And it's a very rigorous process, but we made it through in a year, which is very impressive.
Great. Thanks, John. So, and when that becomes available, I think if that's a kosher thing to do, we'll make sure that those who have registered for the webinar get an email notification of its release and availability. Gene, if I could hand it back to you to see if some of the speakers are still available and any of the questions, if you're able to identify any questions that we can pose to them.
Absolutely. So I'm going to take a question here that seemed to be a reoccurring theme. And it was generally directed at Deb, but then it came back up again during some of the case studies. So, Deb, I'm going to point this question to you, but I'll invite those who shared case studies to weigh in. There's this concept that there are overlaps with standard heavy construction. And the exact quotes are, aren't there huge overlaps with standard heavy construction? And I don't know if you can comment about the typical construction equipment that we might use in this overlap and how the guide would overlap or interface with that.
You know, I guess the question is what do you mean by overlap? But I'm saying I think any remediation site, not any, many remediation sites have are large construction projects. And the BMPs that we have put together as a task group, which was a huge process putting together the BMP table, are applicable to construction sites just like they're applicable to a cleanup site. Wouldn't matter. They're all usable.
Yeah.
I hope that answered it. And, John, maybe you want to...
And the same would go for a number of stormwater management and wastewater management and other civil projects.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have any of the
instructors... We did see, and I think there was a question about Leanne's. I think one of her projects was thermal. We did hear from John some specific BMPs that were unique to in situ thermal technology. So the appendix, not the what's called addendum?
Appendix X3.
Or X3. It is broken out by remedial technology and BMPs that apply to them. But I think as these folks have said, there are a lot of common types of work that are common to any project. We've often been removing dirt, we've been removing water. So for those, there are BMPs that are probably almost universal, yes.
So, for example, if you use the filter excavation surface restoration, which is what Michelle uses a lot, then that would apply pretty much to any construction project.
Hmm. Okay. Can anyone comment about issues when they're trying to recycle concrete on site or anywhere else? Have any of the presenters encountered that as a problem or perhaps had an issue but they managed to resolve it so they could recycle the concrete?
This is Leanne. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear Leanne talk? Okay. We've had issues with concrete recycling. There's issues with lead-based paint on a lot of the concrete. I know that we try to recycle. We resolve it through either doing a cost-benefit analysis, seeing if the abatement plus the recycling is going to be less expensive than just sending it off to a landfill. Another issues that we've had here are crushing concrete, making sure that it's the type of equipment that you need to crush concrete is fairly expensive, so it's almost got to be a large enough amount, a large enough volume to use. And sometimes we've had situations where we'll allow for like adjoining properties or like if there's properties in the area that have concrete and we actually have a small crusher, a small crushing operation, we'll let them bring, like other sister agencies will bring their concrete to our area and we'll crush it and then we'll put it back in the hole so that we're not just putting a crusher down for a small amount of concrete.
Excellent. Leanne, while I've got you on the line, we did have a few people ask for just some clarifying or additional information about the method that you used when you were treating in situ the lead-contaminated soil.
Oh, sure. There was a product called, I believe it was called Massatite, and it's a powder treatment. And what they do is they basically take the powder and then they lay it in lifts, and 1 foot lifts across the site. They use excavation equipment, and what they'll do is they'll mix it in with that lead treatment, with that lead contaminated soil. The next day you can come and take a test of that material, and if it renders under 5 milligrams per liter, then you can take it off to a Subtitle D facility versus a Subtitle C facility. has not rendered hazardous waste any longer.
Excellent. Thank you. We do have another general question, and I'll punt it up to anybody who presented today. Are there any examples where remedy selection was affected by application of this greener cleanup guidance? So, for example, were you looking at doing containment in place rather than doing dig and haul treatment after going through this standard?
That was clearly not the intent of the standard. The remedy selection, and that's how it can complement, you know, any cleanup program. The remedy process, whether it's RCRA or Superfund or a state program, is the remedy process. The idea of the standard is to help minimize the footprint of all phases, but say out of the remedy selection process, not intended to influence that in any way.
Yeah, I mean, most remedy selection processes that we've identified, they include or incorporate through one of the questions that inform the remedy decision, this concept of the standard guide and footprint fits in. However, rarely, our finding is, rarely will it significantly leverage the decision in one direction or the other. And ultimately, we are going to select a cleanup, and we're going to have to build it. So the question is, how can we build that selected cleanup with a low environmental footprint? And that's really where we see the value of the standard guide.
Excellent. Thanks, Carlos. We have another question, and they directed it at Deb, but again, we'll open it up to others. It's also related to one of your poll questions posed to the audience. This participant wants to know, you know, well, this sounds really cool in theory, but really, where do we get off in its application in practice? Do our contractors have an incentive to follow that standard guide? And if so, what are the incentives? It's great to tell people this is what we should be doing, but what will make them actually do it?
Well, I think there's different ways it's going to be influenced by the agency. So, for example, through grants may help and through recognition. So, for example, I was recently at the AEHS conference in Amherst, and Massachusetts announced that they are going to have a Greener Cleanup Leadership Award, which, you know, again, is recognition for those that are doing greener cleanups. There's also recognition, I'm going to pass to Carlos in the Superfund program coming forward, I mean, or certainly incentives, and maybe you have some other...
Yeah, I think there, we call them drivers. So sometimes it could be a driver or an incentive. It could be, a requirement or an incentive. As far as drivers, we've heard some of them. For example, the Region 10 determined, at least on the Superfund side, they included in the contracting language for the cleanup that was going to take place. There's a clear incentive, of course. It's more than an incentive. For a contractor to come forward with their best ideas as far as implementing the standard guide and the BMPs that go with it. But that's a big broad spectrum of drivers, which is contract requirements. For those of you who are tracking Superfund contracting at a mega scale, you may know that there are three contracts in the pipeline, national level contracts. Statements of work were released as part of a request for information. They included references in sections 1.4 of all three contracts to the standard guide as a means of implementing greener cleanups, which were pretty strongly worded as a requirement. Again, those are draft. They're not out there yet, but it is a direction we are moving in. On the incentive side, there's quite a bit going on as well. We've heard of, you know, some of them, some soft sides, starting from a recognition of implementation of standard guides. So that's for the site owner. So if the site owner cleans up a site, does it following the standard guide voluntarily, there may be some recognition from multiple sources on that. I don't know if any examples you want.
I think, Leanne, didn't you get a recognition for the work at the Whitney Young site?
Yeah, we'd received one for actually the Chinatown Library site, the implementation of a greener cleanup there, as well as some of the other projects from NAP. But I agree with Carlos, and it's really important that the consultants are buying on early in the process, because, yes, you can, you know, we as an agency, I'm a governmental agency on behalf of the City of Chicago, can, you know, implement it. But it has to be implemented as a policy starting with us. So then the environmental consultants need to understand what the cleanup policy is, pardon me, the ASTM requirements are and how they're how they can be integrated into specifications so that the contractors can readily exercise that. And there also should be definitely like kickoff meetings with these contractors where these types of things are highlighted, like the no idling policy and the use of, you know, greener vehicles. And so some of those things, the contractors don't tend to always read their specifications and their contracts, as you'll come to find. So it's really important that you have an administrator and a consultant that's out there and really talking through these things with the contractor so he fully understands, especially at the pre-bid meetings and then when you're doing your kickoff meetings.
Right. And that,
go ahead.
So yeah, that's a really good point. We're working both angles. We're working, you know, with our regions, with the different programs, with the states, and figuring out what we can do to request, require, see the application of the guide to our sites. But we're also working on with a consulting engineering firm, having webinars such as this one, going to big conferences such as Battelle, getting the word out, because we do want and expect and are seeing, as I mentioned in the opening, that a lot of consulting engineering firms are starting to build this in and put it forward to us in advance without us necessarily having to pull it out. So we see it happening from both angles.
And another incentive is that many, in fact, I would say the vast majority of the BMPs are ways to save the project money as well.
Absolutely.
I was just going to, one last thing. I know when we had this task group, we had a variety of people, and there were some people from industry who were there because there were corporate sustainability goals, and their remediation program needed a way to, you know, say that they, too, were being more sustainable. So there, it supports any corporate or sustainability goals, which is also an incentive.
And which is, I think, the 60% of the response is to what is the driver for implementing the standard guide was a corporate agency policy. So it's, but of course that could be both on the demand supply side, right? It could be either one, but I think mostly it's on the demand side, either as a site owner or regulatory agency requiring or requesting it. Good. So
I'll just reemphasize that for the PCB program in Region 10, we require it for gaining approval to do your PCB cleanup.
Perfect. I think that's in line with what we saw there. Okay. Any other? I think we are 50 minutes over.
Yep.
And let me just ask if there's anybody else of the speakers that have anything they would like to add. No. Well, with that, we appreciate your participation. Thanks for those of you who are able to hang in a little bit longer. We hope this was of value to you. Hand it back to Jean for the closing comments and the feedback.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Carlos. I want to echo the thanks to the 160 individuals who joined us from all over the world. We did have international participants sitting in on today's session, so thank you. I apologize for going over late, but we did record the entire session, so if you had to leave us early, we'll be able to share the recording shortly so you'll play back anything that you missed. If you're interested in staying on top of new webinars such as today's, you're certainly welcome to visit the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org or follow or connect with us via popular social and professional networking sites. As noted earlier, all of the presentation materials, as well as a number of the links that were discussed during today's training, are currently available on the Links or Resources page. That URL will be active from today forward. You can find it under the Related URLs pod on the middle of your screen called Seminar Resources. The contact information for presenters and organizers can also be found on the seminar homepage. If you have a question or have other things that we weren't able to discuss during today's webinar, you're certainly welcome to reach out and contact those instructors. And as noted, I will ask for you to take just a moment and share a short form for your feedback for today's session. We do have a hyperlink to the online feedback form, and we rely on your comments to help us to continue to offer free online webinars such as today's session. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can fill out the form and have their own feedback submitted under their own name. For those of you looking for certificates, we don't necessarily issue them for all of our Cluin webinars, but if you fill out the feedback form, you can check a box on that form to request a confirmation email that will at least verify that you shared feedback after the live delivery, and that's usually enough to help verify your attendance in the event with your accrediting institution. If you are one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, all of those links are still active, and you can still submit feedback after today's session based off the recording that you're watching. With that, I want to thank everyone who was able to join us for today's broadcast and hope that you will join us on a future webinar. Many thanks to those instructors who participated today and shared their invaluable information. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.